Everybody, this is Coach Porrick from the Humble Coach Podcast. Hope you're all doing fantastic. This is episode number 41, and I'm joined today by the fantastic coach, Carmen Bott. So Carmen is a professor of kinesiology at Langara College and Simon Fraser College in Vancouver in Canada. She's a performance consultant to a number of different sports and athletes. She's the author of The Wrestler's Edge. She has coached three world medalists. Carmen has a fantastic level of experience in both academia and in real world coaching. So I'm really looking forward to you guys and listening to our conversation today. Enjoy.
Okay, folks, so welcome back. This is Coach Porrick from the Humble Coach Podcast. This is episode 41, everybody, and thank you so much for listening so far. I'm joined today by a brilliant, brilliant coach. She's a phenomenally experienced and brilliant, I suppose, both coach educator, an exercise physiologist, wrestling coach, multi-sport coach, like the whole biz. But this is a lady called Carmen Bott. And Carmen, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Great stuff. So Carmen, a lot of people will be aware of your activities, be it in the wrestling world or in the strength and conditioning world or even as a professor. But could you give us a little bit of an idea of what you're currently working at and some of the main areas that you work in at the moment, if you could.
Absolutely. Maybe first I'll start by, I don't mean to be corrective, no, but I'm not a wrestling coach. No, I'm purely a physical performance coach on the wrestling side. So I do have a love for that sport and specialize in working with wrestlers, but the actual on-mat stuff, I'll leave it up to the people much smarter than I am and experienced in that stuff. But currently, I'm a full-time professor, actually, at a college called Langara. It's in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and it's a two-year transfer program off to University of British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And I also teach part-time at another institution called Simon Fraser University in their BPK. So it's like a kinesiology department in both schools. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of my main focus. And then on the side, I do see clients. I have usually up to about 8 athletes at any point in time on my roster. And I've been fortunate over the last 4 or 5 years to almost exclusively work with world level, international level athletes in sports like wrestling and even UFC. And I also do quite a bit of consulting in basketball and gridiron football.
Awesome. So that's pretty, you're a busy lady.
I'm pretty busy, yeah, but I'm a work of frolic. So there you go. I like to work. Give me some work.
Awesome. Well, there's a lot of variety there, obviously, and my apologies about the wrestling note there, but I suppose when it comes to the amount of different sports that you work with, you obviously have an interest in the collision sports or wrestling and those type of sports. Is there anything in particular that brought you towards those, or are you agnostic enough to them as well, for the most part?
You know, this is going to sound a little bit out there, but in about 2013, I was doing a little bit of soul searching professionally, and I kind of put it out there to the universe that I wanted to see more kind of warrior type clients, mm-hmm. More like-minded people, I guess. I had a phenomenal stint with UBC basketball back in like year 2000 up to 2006 when I did my master's research at UBC with basketball. We won a couple of national titles. It was phenomenal. And then when I left and I graduated, I was a bit lost for 4 or 5 years, and I was still training people, but I just hadn't really found another niche where I was super keen. And I kind of felt with basketball, I had really explored a lot of the performance in that sport. So I was looking for a new challenge. So I guess coupled looking with a new challenge as well as looking for clients that really were tough, you know, and I guess that's a very vague construct of a word, but clients that were warriors, and then I just started getting MMA fighters were starting to come through my door, and after that, wrestlers. Nice. So, and I've always worked with football players. I've been working with CFL and university-aged athletes since about 2000, and I played flag football for about 10 years in a women's sort of top-flight recreational league in my 30s, so I played this sport, A, because I love to run around and chase things, but I also wanted to learn a lot more about the movement demands of football, especially in skill players, right? Yeah. Where your receivers and DBs and such. So anyway, that's kind of, I think, how it evolved to now. And I'm really, really lucky. I mean, I'm working with kind of the best clients I've really ever had. I mean, the basketball clientele was also phenomenal. They're great, great athletes, but, I've kind of found, you know, my people, I guess.
Hmm. Awesome. Well, I think, and having read a lot about you and watched a lot of your different work over the last number of months, I think you probably, and I say this in the nicest way possible, but you seem to have a warrior mentality towards your work, I would say. And even in any conversations I've ever heard you had or anything like that, any other podcasts, you have a very strong sense of yourself. Now, obviously that's grown over the years, but you're very, very comfortable in being not necessarily combative, but definitely combative for your athletes and in their for their interests. I don't know if you could speak a little bit about some of that and the challenges that you would have dealt with some of those type of collision sport athletes. Is there any particular common themes that you've really enjoyed while training them? That would be quite different than the likes of basketball or different ones like that.
Well, I think with any, I guess the theme might be that the athletes I work with now are at a higher level. Mm-hmm. So they're either kind of at a pro level or a world, like Olympic, you know, world champion kind of level. So that's up there. And when you start to get sort of common denominators, you know, with those types of people and sort of how they approach life, how they deal with, challenge and adversity, how they face fear, their level of intensity. You know, it's funny, I posted a photo on social media the other day and shared it with one of my American wrestlers, and she posted it and she said something in the post like, find yourself a coach that will put up with your death stare, right? So she's looking at me, and I didn't even realize it, but she's looking at me in like quite a way, and I'm looking at the picture kind of having a chuckle, and I wrote back, you know, yeah, we can, this is how you and I communicate. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not afraid. It doesn't intimidate me to work with athletes like this. I mean, we're all human beings. Yeah. And so underneath all that intensity and sort of, you know, I guess bravado that maybe some of these athletes have, they're obviously, they have their vulnerabilities too, just like I have my vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. But they do tend to be quite, the people I attract tend to be quite focused, and, you know, I'm lucky that I get to work with those types. And I guess to speak to your point around, having listened to me talk and I guess in other interviews and whatnot, and then I'm have a strong sense of myself, I guess I do speak with quite a bit of conviction, and I am very passionate, and my intensity is not for everybody. So it's, I always joke to my students at the university, when I'm lecturing, we talk about NARPs, and NARPs are just non-athletic recreational people, right? And I'm a NARP now. I mean, I fully admit that. I think it's quite funny. I go to the gym and I do my NARP mom body workout now, right? Because I'm old. Yeah. But, my mentality is not that really of a NARP. It's that of a very competitive person. Mm-hmm. And I love to compete.
Yeah.
I love to debate. You know, if someone says, I want to argue with you about this, I'm like, okay, let's go. And for me, it's fun. I actually have a smile on my face. Other people would be like, man, I don't want to even go there. So that's my way, I guess, of continuing to compete.
Nice. No, I think it's great. I will admit I'm a little bit like that too. Now, my girlfriend goes crazy with that. She's like, she's a very relaxed kind of person. She's not a very big fan of the argumentative kind of notions, but I quite like a good argument, I have to say.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's where you and I can be buddies, and we can debate back and forth and talk about things. And, you know, I think that's where growth happens. And as long as, you know, those two people or four people that are debating and talking have in the back of their mind, the purpose behind it is growth. And it isn't about ego, right? Or being right. Mm-hmm. It's about discovery. And I'm okay with people busting my chops. But I grew up with a father that busted my chops every single day of my life. And he still busts my chops, you know, so... And I had teachers that bust my chops, and I had coaches that did. Everybody nowadays is so worried about, oh, no, I'm going to offend somebody, right? Mm. When really sometimes people need to hear the truth. And you tell athletes, like, look, get your head out of your ass and let's get going here. You're fine.
Yeah.
Right? Here we go.
I agree. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think there definitely can be, I mean, we have to be sensitive, absolutely. But I think, especially to take your point there, if you're dealing with those type of athletes and that caliber of an athlete, then yeah, they've kind of made a choice. So there's obviously sensitivities towards them as a human, of course, but you have to deal with the reality of the situation that if they want to get to these places and do these things, they're going to have to go through these trials. And that's just, it's just a fact of the situation.
It really boils down to what they do with an adverse situation. Mm-hmm. You know, do they rise to the challenge with the possibility that you could fail, or do they avoid it? Right. Yeah. And if they've got the support, and that's my role, you know, is support staff at the end of the day. I'm there to give them a hug if they need it afterwards, but I'm still going to make them do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So the next point I'm going to go towards is, and it's related towards the avenue that you've gone in the direction of, I suppose, with those very, very high level athletes. But you don't necessarily have any particular methodology to your training. I know I've spoken to different coaches before that may have they may have a particular system or something like that going on, but and I'm not going to say that you necessarily have a particular philosophy, but could you speak a little bit about philosophy versus methodology, and the, I suppose, the differences between those and your own take on them, if you could?
Certainly, yeah. Philosophy, in my opinion, is more to do with your core values as a human being. So if I value being on time or being early for appointments, and that's important to me as a professional, as an individual, I'm going to talk to the athlete that I'm working with about that core value. We're going to discuss whether or not we're on the same page. We share that philosophy. Mm-hmm. That would be kind of an example. Methodology would be, you know, the recipe for a training outcome. And I always use the analogy when I'm teaching that it's a lot like cooking. If I'm going to make spaghetti sauce, mm-hmm. right, I could make it with pesto, I could make it with tomato sauce, I could add mushrooms, I could add onions or whatever, right? But at the end of the day, there are commonalities in the spaghetti sauce that make it spaghetti sauce. However, the ingredients can be manipulated. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a, I don't want to say creative, because I don't think training people on the exercise prescription side is an overly creative process. That's one thing I actually don't really enjoy, is the fact that it's not creative. It's fairly methodical and robotic, and plus this equals this. So that's more your baking than your cooking. If I put too much baking soda in, it's going to taste really gross.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be a half a teaspoon or the metric system, right? Whatever it is. I do not subscribe to a methodology, and the word system, I'll be perfectly honest to tell your readership that it grosses me out. Mm-hmm. When people say, oh, this is my system, I get a funny look on my face, and I usually stop talking. I excuse myself from the room and go have a beer. Because you're dealing with a biological system. I just used the word, but you're dealing with biology, right? Yes. Human biology that fluctuates day to day, week to week, month to month. So the choices that I'm making are a recipe that once I start to cook, which is coach, I manipulate right then and there if I need to. That's actually what I believe the principle of individualization is. Mm-hmm. It isn't individualizing training programs per se. It's showing up on the day of training, and that's what coaching is. Coaching isn't writing programs. Right. And then going, OK, I noticed that, you hurt your foot at practice yesterday. There's always something, you know, there's no such thing as an athlete or a fitness participant that doesn't have an owie. Mm-hmm. They do every single session. So people that go into coaching just need to go, oh, OK, so it's triage. Absolutely. Then if you're working with a team, sometimes I'm on field with, no joke, 60 guys, 60 football players and little me. Right. And I'm trying to educate them and coach them and make adjustments all at the same time in an hour, right?
Yeah.
That's what coaching is. So how do you systemize that? I don't know. I think you need to have testing, and I think you need to have measurable outcomes that are physical and physiological, 100%.
Yeah.
but I don't think you need to. And I'm so glad that I haven't been typecasted as the endurance girl or the power girl or the strength girl or coach or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't call myself a strength coach. I'm a strength and conditioning coach.
Yeah.
I am equally as good at coaching strength and power as I am coaching endurance and prescribing that to the populations I train. And I think in our current environment, I guess, or world we live in now, that we're seeing people specializing. I'm a movement guy. Yeah. I'm a power guy. I'm an Olympic lifting coach, and that's all they know. Well, that's fine if that's all you do. Yeah. But if you want to work with teams and you want to work with athletes or even general pop, like you want to be a fitness trainer, you need to know everything. You need to know all components of fitness.
Yeah.
And know them well and know how to prescribe and coach exercise around that, right? So
there's totally a challenge. I totally agree. I think that can be an interesting one. Like, there's a couple of different points there, but when, like, even with the word strength coach, I've always kind of bugged me, I suppose, that kind of strength coach scenario. Because I suppose we in Europe and in Ireland and in the UK and stuff like that, we'd very much call it a strength and conditioning coach, and it's primarily based as a team sport athletic trainer, if that makes sense, rather than even on an individual basis, then it becomes like a personal trainer kind of a thing. But the strengths and the individual mentality towards different areas of fitness or athleticism, I suppose, not that I don't respect them for their interests, of course, but I do think, and having the experience myself of worked with different sports, I find myself in a much better position now to be able to actually analyze those sports as a more generalist approach for now, rather than going in with the only, okay, this is all I know, and I'm just this kind of guy here, and I don't ask for much advice, or else I bring it in, like you mentioned earlier on, that there's a very heavy kind of powerlifting orientation towards particular teams, when the needs analysis of the entire sport and the team that you're working with would be much more varied than that. So it can be very, very difficult to try and I suppose appreciate the single-mindedness of some of those kind of coaches. But I've always found it just challenging with a strength coach kind of I think it doesn't sit well with me either. So it's a challenge, all right.
It's definitely something that kind of was born after I became certified, you know, 22 years ago or 23 years ago. It was strength and conditioning specialist, right, through the NSCA, and then you called yourself a strength and conditioning coach. And then now, I mean, sometimes I'll call myself a performance coach or a physical performance coach, but it's interesting. Like, I'm even looking into another designation right now on mental performance, where I'd be called a mental performance consultant, right? So that's good because that identifies that it's mental. It's not like, so when people say I'm a performance consultant, I sometimes call myself that too. I probably shouldn't because performance is a really big word and it encompasses a lot, right? Anyway.
Definitely. No, I think so. Like I'd say it, I don't say it enough, I think it's the same as yourself, but I like, obviously I'm a CrossFit coach and a personal trainer, but I call myself a movement coach more than anything else sometimes. But so that's going to move us on to the next kind of a question. And speaking that, I think we've spoken a little bit about some of the training principles, but your own particular training principles that you like to kind of guide all of your decisions with your athletes. And could you speak a little bit about the concept of engagement of working with the athletes rather than entertainment, or the kind of battle between those, especially with some of the teams you would work with, but also even on an individual level with some of the different athletes you would work with? Could you speak a little bit about those?
Did I say that somewhere?
Well, I've stolen a couple of things off you here now to kind of jog to check it out and see what you think a little more.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess coaching to me isn't about necessarily entertaining. And entertaining is kind of like motivation. Mm-hmm. People say, oh, this is, you know, this meme on Instagram is meant to motivate you, right? Mm-hmm. Memes don't motivate people, you know? And motivation is a transient construct. It's like you wake up in the morning and some days you're really motivated. Other days you're like, oh, God, I'm tired. I need coffee. Mm-hmm. okay, now here we go. And that's normal. That's part of being a human being. Nobody is, you know, jacked up every single day. So motivation is kind of an interesting thing. And I think entertainment kind of fits in a similar vein that, you know, you might watch the same movie three times. And the first time you laughed a lot. And the second time you thought it was stupid. And then the third time, I think maybe this is me being a female saying this, because girls never watch movies more than once. That's a boy thing.
But boys totally do. We do all the time.
Boys totally do.
All the time.
I love boys. They're awesome. But I can give you a million boy-isms. You'd be shocked, because I work coach with so many boys or coach so many boys. But, you know, it's kind of redundant, right, where engagement hits home. It's hitting somebody right in their soul, in what, again, back to core values, right? What is it that makes them tick, and what's their purpose? You know, what's their why? And if you can figure that out, you need to figure it out. If you're working with a team, you need to collectively figure that out. And usually I'll work with the coaching staff to figure out or ask, hey, what's our mission? What's our mission statement with this team? And good coaches right away. Some of the coaches I work with would tell me that right off the bat, off the top of their head, because they're that dialed in with their team and they know how to build the team, if you will. And so if I go with that, right, with my sessions, and we talk a lot about the same things and the same values and the same mission, the athletes are immediately engaged. So engagement is a byproduct. It's not my, I don't go, okay, I'm going to write the most engaging workout. You know, I can engage people by connecting with them and hitting those core key values and the mission statement of that particular person or team. But the key with it, if any of your readership are working with athletes, is to sit down with the coaching staff. And that's where you're going to get really valuable advice around engagement.
I think I definitely, that leads me on to the next kind of piece of this, and in the same vein, speaking about some of the challenges of working in some of the environments that you work in currently or have worked in, with a significant number of other coaches on that staff for the group of athletes you're working with, teams. And can you speak a little bit about the real importance of that shared mission statement, that shared vision, and then the ideology of the whole group, in line with the ethos of the college that you're working at, or the school or whatever it is. But even that, if it's with like Wrestling Canada or with something like that, then there's going to be very, very high level values and a respect approach towards it. So could you speak a little bit about some of the difficulties of working in those kind of settings and the importance of really combining all of the coaches together to work as a team?
Usually when I get asked this question, I sort of go back in time to the experience I had at the University of British Columbia. So in a varsity setting, as a strength and conditioning coach, we won a couple of national titles with women's basketball, a really successful program. And people ask me, you know, what was the secret? Obviously, they're going to ask the head coach that much more than they'll ever ask me as the strength and conditioning person. But I just would say, well, we would kill for each other. Like, we loved each other. Yeah. Everybody loved everybody, you know, like the coaches loved each other. The mental performance consultant loved the athletes. They loved her. Our physio was amazing. He traveled with us. There were, you know, everybody was on the same page. So you're right. In order for at least a team to be really successful, you need to close any gaps of not even miscommunication, but no communication. There needs to be communication. With the other positive experiences I've had in other sports, like even MMA, I'm working with a guy right now who has a great team, and he's put his team together because he's a former Olympian in freestyle wrestling for Canada. He competed in 2012 in London, and he was a Commonwealth Games gold medalist as a heavyweight. So he has a lot of experience as an athlete. So because of that, what he's been able to do is put together kind of like-minded people, I guess. People with a similar philosophy, like you mentioned earlier, but not necessarily the same method, because we all have different roles, but everybody has the same mission. And he actually created that. That's the unique piece. So athletes sometimes don't realize how much power they have. I have another girl who competes for the USA in freestyle wrestling, and she's basically built her own team as well with mental performance, with strength and conditioning, with her technical coaching staff here in Canada. She trains here, and because she went to university here, but she also goes to Colorado Springs quite frequently and trains with the US world team. She's got coaching staff there. She's got physiologists there that will communicate with me if I want some blood testing done on her. You know, she's been a real businesswoman at her young age about it. And I mean, I think part of that is maybe a bit of my influence, because I've always told my female athletes, be a businesswoman. Let's go be a businesswoman. Like, you can create what you want. You have more power than you think. And I don't mean power as in I'm going to waltz in and do what I want. Not at all.
Of course.
But you can pick and choose who you want to work with. I have had very negative experiences working with coaches, but I'm not here to talk about negative things. All I will share with your readership is that if you try to communicate with coaches and they don't want to communicate with you, well, then maybe it's not meant to be. Maybe that's not an ideal relationship for you. You know, I have, you know, been in situations where there has been miscommunications and people thought, you know, or maybe, I don't want to speak for people, so to be careful, but maybe people didn't act in good faith, you know, and benefit of the doubt on either side of the fence. And those are damaging problems as well. So I think what needs to happen and what I've done, you know, kind of moving forward from anything negative is that when an athlete is going to take me on to work with them, the first person I call is their coach. And I tell the athlete that. And even on my intake forms, so on my Wrestler's Edge, you know, product that I sell in the intake forms, it says, like, who's your coach? So the performance coach, strength conditioning coach is phoning that coach saying, you know, hey, your athlete has hired me to work with them. Is there anything you can share with me? And usually when you open that door, they want to talk about that athlete. They want to help you. They want to give you feedback. And, and their feedback is almost more, honestly, 9 times out of 10 more valuable than a testing battery. You know, because they've got like real practice feedback. And then the next question you ask is, do I have permission to come to practice? Watch. And then you need to be careful. You know, some coaches get upset if you engage the athlete verbally during a practice. So you sit back and you watch with your notepad. Other coaches, like the football coach at the university, he lets me stand on the sidelines with the team. And I chat with guys that are injured and not playing, and we watch the game together. He's a little more laid back about it. So, you know, you kind of have to be a chameleon. You don't always know where the boundaries are with people. And the only way you will know is by asking.
Yeah, I think that's actually, that's fantastic. I mean, and something's resonated with me there straight away. I'm reading Brett Bartholomew's book at the moment, Conscious Coaching, and
he speaks. Oh, that guy. Yeah, oh, my God.
He's so hot right now. That
guy. I left him a really, really funny message this morning.
he's pretty famous these days, but that's really interesting because he speaks a lot about the buy-in for the athletes, but you've made a really interesting point there that the buy-in from the other coaches and the delicacy of the approach to the other coaches whenever there is dealing with athletes is just as important to make sure that you can actually get a really, really good community built for that person and support structure like, built for that person.
I've made some serious mistakes, you know, for the point I've had coaches chew me out for talking to their athletes during a practice. So just you know, and it's funny because I'm only me and I can only be me, but I've had to learn to be more careful. You know, or to choose to work with coaches that give me a bit more of the benefit of the doubt and don't think of me as a threat or can come up to me a little and say, hey, you know what? Be better if, you know, you talk to athletes after the practice and, you know, And that's fine. If that's their wish, hey, they're the head coach. But I do have complete respect for that. So I've had to learn.
No, that's all good. That's okay. It's no problem. The next kind of thing. Now, I've stolen a couple, because you're pretty good at the old internet, and you're definitely getting better at it.
Brett were following you, he's taught me everything I know.
Yeah, we'll give him some of the royalties, definitely, if there's any royalties.
Yeah, hell no. Anyway.
But we can. So I've stolen a little. Like, you've got a little quote on your Twitter handle, and it says, "The doubt never ends, the learning never stops." So I can appreciate the learning never stops. But could you expand a little bit about the doubt never ends? I'm just kind of curious on that.
I mean, that's a scientist mindset.
Okay.
Right. So I have one foot in academia all the time. Mm-hmm. And so as a scientist, we're very doubtful, you know, doubtful of not of our own abilities. It's more on what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Right. It's like, okay, well, this is what this is what the body of evidence currently suggests as best practice. And that's what we're going with. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so that's what I mean by doubt. Even though I can speak with conviction and sound like I'm, you know, very confident, at the end of the day, we don't really know, right? We make inferences.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because, and I've definitely seen you speaking about this before, and read you speaking about this before, the balance of academia and real life coaching, I suppose, at the same stage, the in the trenches kind of a scenario can be challenging. But like you mentioned there, it's not like we have distinct training principles. We have distinct physiology principles that we have to, well, not necessarily have to abide by, because different things change those as it goes along. But like you mentioned, the biology is the biology, but it also is a very, very fluid system that can distinctly change at any stage, and it's definitely going to change the approach that we would have with the individual athletes or individual teams, depending on the new evidence. So we're obviously going to change our approach if the ground is shifting beneath our feet a little bit with certain areas of athleticism or training, then we have to move along with them. So I think that can be very, very helpful to have that consistent doubtful mentality towards, like, well, I'm not going to be able to just get cozy here and stuck in my same old beliefs all the time. I think that's very, very important.
Yeah, I think it's dangerous to be complacent. I quite despise that sort of that state, but I also would caution people to go with what the body of evidence suggests, not evidence. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
very much.
Sometimes a study will come out. I saw one the other day. The guy said, cold water immersion at at 50 degrees Celsius improved sprint performance in MMA fighters in 24 hours, like 24 hours later.
Jesus Christ.
Right? Yeah. So now people are going to go, I'm going to put people in cold tubs, you know, for this long, and then the next day they're going to run faster, when sprinting is a neuromotor quality. I mean, we just have to be careful, right? If 50 studies and then a meta-analysis said this is what happens, I think we're good. I think we can probably subscribe to that, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Just like, you know, that if you squat, you'll probably, your legs will get stronger. We do know that, right? But, other things, we just have to be take it with a bit of a grain of salt, right?
Yeah.
Kind of be critical. Don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out.
Yeah, I think that's actually really important, because with obviously now everybody and we didn't speak in really much other than Brett earlier on about the social media orientation, but and I'm not the best at the old social media, unfortunately. I need to work a little harder on, I think, and get my message out, etc. But I think with the advent of a lot more content going on Instagram, Facebook, wherever it is, or even if it's Medium or if it's a podcast like this, there's a lot more details coming out about the training in general, and there's a lot more education for be it the layperson or the athlete. And I think sometimes the coach can get a little bit skewed towards those particular type of papers that they might go, well, look, hold on. if they're not as well-rounded of a coach and they don't have a very open mind, they may be quite into their specific orientation, powerlifting, sprinting, whatever it is, then they can maybe get dragged into that little bit of a fight of like, okay, well, I'll use this this type of training protocol now because I saw two papers on it. And that's a dangerous way to go, because you really, really have to, like you mentioned, take the full body, the main body of work, and really, really base your training off that and your approach off that. Absolutely.
100%.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of a different one now, and I didn't mention this before to you, but what's your take on the, and I think it, like I've definitely found it very, very helpful in the last number of months, but the concept of MAF training. I don't know if you're aware of the MAF kind of training. So it's maximum aerobic function training, or basically polarized type of training. So with some of the wrestlers or the MMA athletes that you would deal with, what type of a training protocol do you normally work towards? Is it obviously dependent on their the time of year, the time of their competition schedule, their general ability at the moment, and their general, like their I suppose their seasonality as an athlete. But is there much of do you put in much of an endurance base onto those type of athletes, or are you a bit more power oriented, or does it shift month on month or season on season?
That's a great question. It was kind of the foundation of my last testing manual that I just completed. I look at it this way. I look at something like a VO2 max test. So say you do a shuttle test or a 30-15, any kind of field test, okay, to test VO2. I look at that as what I would consider baseline aerobic fitness for a grappler. So I have targets that I want those athletes to meet, and they're not high. Like for a wrestler, if I have a growth of VO2 in the low 50s, that's sufficient.
Yeah.
Okay. But if she's in like the mid 40s, or a guy, a heavyweight boxer that I consulted with Boxing Canada with just recently for World Championships, and when we first tested her, her VO2 was just too low.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of aerobic power training with her to push the heart up, okay? Because a VO2 test, and this is top secret info for your readership, is about the delivery of oxygenated blood. It doesn't tell us much about extraction or uptake.
Yeah.
Even though they say the Fick equation and blah, 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 it really is an index of the heart's pumping ability. So when you've got a well-trained heart, you're going to have a high VO2 max, right? Yeah. So with wrestlers, they don't need to be really highly trained, because it's a static dynamic sport. So when you analyze it and look at the Russian literature, and I pretty much exclusively use their analysis, most of my mentors are Russian, and the Russians are the best in the world in men's freestyle and Greco. So I will listen to what they have to say. And, you know, what their intake is more like, let's look at the muscle level. Let's look at oxygen uptake and measure like strength endurance and power endurance, and then just pure like muscular endurance.
Yeah.
And look at that, right? So circle back to kind of your question. So if I have somebody that's underdeveloped on the aerobic, the VO2 side, I will pull that up, but it doesn't take me long. Like I can get someone at a decent level in 6 months and then maybe a year. So when I was working with Justina DiSasio, who's our recent gold medalist for Canada at Worlds, she was pretty deconditioned aerobically, and she would admit that. She would be upset if she heard this. and that was, you know, I tested her and her power. I mean, the girl was cleaning 90 kilos, right? I think I got her to 95 in 2 years, 95 kilos. Like, I mean, she's a really strong athlete. That's she's powerful strong. And fast, right? So, and she only weighs 165 pounds. So that's 75 kilos, right? So, anyway, you know, that was kind of the focus the first year that we worked together. And then after that, when she started hitting the targets, then it became more peripheral, and it became more about very specific protocols to pull up local muscular endurance. So if I were to go and test her again, her VO2 wouldn't have you know, wouldn't have changed. Her VO2, mind you, is really high now.
Yeah.
I managed to get her. I think genetically she just had a big ceiling,
mm-hmm.
and we got her into the 60s.
Okay, nice.
So when she went into world, she was in the low 60s. And we also do threshold testing. So her threshold was close to 86% of her max heart rate. So she had a really good threshold.
Nice.
She was able to work at a really good rate, you know, without becoming too acidic, right?
Mm.
So I use a lot of interval training protocols to develop that high intensity work, getting the heart rate up high. But you know, the heart is not a machine. It can't be trained like that 4 days a week, all year round. It's not. There's some evidence to suggest, I'm going to sit on the fence here, that you know the heart can acidify just like muscle can, if pH changes too much, if we're shuttling too much lactate there. So I do go through phases where I have the athletes do static dynamics, which is a lot of that is Verkachansky's work.
Yeah.
Where you take a percent 1RM, usually quite light, like 30%, and you go through very slow muscle contractions, you know, slow compared to, you know, jumping and running.
Yeah.
And you do that for time, right? Mm-hmm. And you do that over time. And you do it, you use something called a serial method. And you probably know about that, but your listeners might not, where you might do, I'll give you guys a quick protocol. So you take 30% of your back squat. You'll squat that for 30 seconds, really slow, no pauses. That's really important. So it's down for two, up for two. So this is more of a muscle endurance protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And then you rack the bar and you just shake your limbs loose for 30 seconds. And you do that for 5 rounds. So literally the clock's running for about 5 minutes. Then you put shoes on and head outside and go for a run for about 8 minutes. Now it depends on the athlete. Some athletes will clear the acid in six.
Yeah.
But we'll start with 8, and it's really slow jog. I call it a yog. That's just a funny thing. I use yogging, and we're just kind of trotting along. Heart rate is maybe like 125.
Maybe, yeah.
And then we do it again, and we go for a jog, and we do it again. It doesn't have to be jogging. It could be cycling, anything that's rhythmic and aerobic, right? So there's a protocol where we're improving that local muscular endurance for the slow fibers.
Yeah.
So I look a lot at fiber recruitment in terms of what I'm trying to target. If I want to target the slow guys and wrestlers, they need to have both. They need to have great endurance in the slow and in the fast because of all the isometric holds and whatnot that tend to recruit more of the lower threshold motor units. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does actually. Like I think one of the interesting things, the more I delve into, and I wouldn't be the best sports science scientist in the world, now mind, I'm not a it wouldn't be my background, but I think I'm becoming more and more interested by the day in the actual activity of sports science and the analytics of it and the details of it. And I think when you're dealing with I can see clearly now, I think that there's always a time where every coach will have, if they're whatever kind of people they're working with, be it lay people, be it athletes, be it a team, whatever it is, they'll have a bit of a fog that they will be kind of stuck in. And then every so often you'll talk to different people, or you'll deal with different people that will separate that fog quite quickly. And when it comes to the likes of that, I think that's very similar to MAF training and very similar to a quite polarized approach. But I think that's the best thing about it, is that there's a number of different ways to skin the proverbial cat. But in your kind of situation that you mentioned there, it depends on the likes of the motor recruitment. It depends on the fiber type that you're trying to work with. It very much depends. All of these things depend on the actual person and the athlete and what they need. And I think that's where it's coming back more and more in my head and my heart to that mentality. Irrelevant of what the actual needs are, it very much should be, okay, this is what this particular person needs at this particular time. Because some other people will have, like, you probably dealt with a number of athletes who are very hard charging, and they're well able to actually handle the volume. Like you mentioned, that lady in particular, they can handle a lot more volume or a lot more intensity over a longer period of time. They can just, I suppose the best way I like to look at the professionals is that their heart rate may be at a crazy high point, but they're still thinking very clearly and very well able to perform their sport or their activity. And that's the dream scenario, really.
Yep, absolutely. You know, that's the really the highest level of fitness. And that's, I guess, to circle back, why I think we really have to get good at conditioning athletes and people, because there's a health component to it, too, with the general population. Yeah,
very much. Mm-hmm.
And I hate to sound arrogant, but getting people strong is easy.
Yeah.
If I had an 18-year-old boy in the weight room, like, I'm going to look like a friggin' genius. I mean, he's full of testosterone. He doesn't have any responsibilities other than his homework.
Yeah.
And he's going to get ridiculously strong over that first year, you know,
definitely.
But did I improve his performance, and what do I need to do, you know, to improve his endurance? Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of things nowadays, like finishers, and like, to me, that's just garbage. Like, what, you're going to send your client home full of acid? Like, that makes no sense to me whatsoever, but you see it everywhere. You see it in MMA gyms, you see it. Maybe even CrossFit. I don't know much about CrossFit, but where it's at the end of the workout, now we're going to do all of this heavy acidic glycolytic work. And there's a time and a place for it. Don't get me wrong, but it's a peaking tactic.
Yeah.
It's a peaking tactic doing that stuff with athletes. Mm-hmm. It's not something we do all the time, because there's a cost to doing that business, and that's called recovery. And if I've got a kid and all my athletes train twice a day, they've got a second session. I'll give you guys a quick story. There, I tested two athletes in my lab this week at school. One of them, one of the kids, has a resting heart rate of 39. He did a 2.4k run in under 9 minutes, and he's a pretty strong guy. He's really aerobically trained. Okay. So we tested him on a Wingate, 30 seconds on the bike with 7.5% of his mass, against Mallory Velte, my world bronze medalist, on a Wingate. Mallory didn't hit the same peak power as this guy did. He has more peak power, but his power drop off over 30 seconds was 100%. Hers was 40.
Christ.
She went and lifted weights, did her full strength routine about 4 hours later, and he had to go to bed. You know, he said, I have never felt that horrible. And the thing is, he said to me, everything he does is alactic.
Yeah.
Here, there's people that preach this, like Charlie Francis's whole, like, disciples, they all preach about this alactic. Oh, everything should be alactic and glycolytic. Well, it depends.
Yeah.
If you are a grappler or you're a wrestler, you need some lactic work in your programming. I mean, and there's some evidence right there in terms of how your body deals with the pH change, like the buffering agents that are available, as well as the enzymes. And those are the two things we impact with peaking tactics. We don't impact capillary density and mitochondria and all those fun things that I do lots of research on. That's through, like, good aerobic training protocols. But so that's still the majority of your training is still 80% doing that stuff, but you still need to do 20%, you know, where you're under recovered, if you will, set. And that's what's going to challenge that system. And the only difference with my athletes, it depends on the time of year. So if we're getting ready for a major competition, the wrestling coaches will put that stuff in at practice. And they're really good at it. The coaches I work with are very good. And then they taper them to out of the major comp. And they're ready to go. They're ready to roll. I mean, the weeks that they're going through this at practice is hell. You know, like, they're exhausted. But they recover and they perform.
Yeah.
You know, but we don't do it like that all year round.
No.
You know, it's just to get ready for 2 to 3 major competitions, right?
Yeah. And I think that
general fitness enthusiasts, they should do it to test themselves. You know, do it. You're not going to die, you know?
No, true. Exactly. But I think that's actually really interesting that, like, it's very appropriate. And I absolutely agree that if you are working with athletes that, and especially athletes that are going to a very, very high level, a world level, et cetera, that's essentially their livelihood. So you've got to be really, really delicate with that. And you've got to put the stuff in at the right time and at the right appropriate point. But you've also got to really ask the questions of them. But I do think that there's it ebbs and flows a bit now, I think, but, and I think this a lot of the time can come back to either the media's reporting of it or the evolution of different coaches' mentalities. Is sometimes the the mentality towards, even in the CrossFit kind of realm, like I've done that in the past, not recently now, mind. I'm not a huge fan of the mad finisher kind of stuff. I'm much more of a general maybe core work or a general actual cool down and just approaching it in a different way. But I think it can be very, very helpful to see a lot more athletes and hear even a lot more high level coaches speaking about that kind of polarized type of an approach or a very smart approach. But I think without a shadow of a doubt, the conditioning element is so, so important for general health, but even just the general long-term health of the athlete themselves, rather than just living only in the elective world and only trying to force a small window of opportunity to maybe hit a particular peak. It's much more of a longer term approach. I think that's important. I don't know if you'll agree with that.
I do. I just think, like you said, mm-hmm. there's a time and a place for it. And I definitely don't think it's ever at the end of a training session. I think using, if you want to do glycolytic power work or glycolytic capacity work, the serial method is really the best method to use, because it does help you to stress that system without creating a very significant pH change where your body now has to fight to bring itself back to a baseline level. Yeah. That's what recovery is, right? Mm-hmm. Is trying to oxidize the change in pH. And if you don't have to spend a lot of time doing that, then that's usually a good thing. Even if it's a soccer mom that you're training and she's got to go and pick kids up and do this and go grocery shopping, she doesn't need to be feeling like she can't walk up a set of stairs. But there is there are times when we do need to stress the body at high intensities. You know, I've given prescriptions to athletes where they'll do, and it depends on the athlete. Like I have athletes that can go 30 seconds on a bike and give me, let's say, wattage at 80% of their max wattage the entire 30 seconds.
Yeah.
If you get an average person, will not be able to do that.
No way.
You know, so there's that piece too. So everything has to be prescribed based on what that person can currently do. Mm-hmm. And I remember I gave an athlete that, and I gave her 4 minutes of rest between intervals. Mm-hmm. And that's actually true glycolytic power work, right? Where, maybe coaches would say, oh, that's way too much rest. You know, why are you resting for so long? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still training that system.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that I have enough time to clear as much acid as possible. It's not going to be perfect, but I also can repeat the work.
Yeah.
So I always say, can you repeat the work? That's set to set, rep to rep, and day to day, and week to week.
Yeah.
If you can't, then you're not adapting. You might be overreaching, which again, there might be a time and a place for that. That's a 2 week block here and there, right? Yeah. But for the most part, we should be adapting and we should be able to repeat that work. And if we can't and it starts looking sloppy, then we need more recovery or we need less load or whatever. Coaches need to make those adjustments and they need to educate people.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think that's absolutely on point. I'm gonna leave you after the last couple of questions, if that's okay, Carmen.
Yes.
So I've stolen a quote, I think, from an article you wrote an article, but I think somebody else may have said it, but they may have said, never let them see you sweat. Could you explain what that kind of means, potentially?
Oh, yeah. That's actually from a guy named Joey Delceni, who was my boss when I lived in Malaysia. Yeah. Joey actually lives in Malaysia still, and he owns a company called Lila, which is a Exogen performance suit that he's developed for endurance athletes and speed athletes. He's a smart guy, really, really good coach. And awesome. You know, as a coach, you need to stay calm, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're not calm and centered and relaxed, the kids that you're working with will feel that and feed off that energy. I was watching a rugby game on the weekend. My son is 8 and he plays like mini rugby. And there's a coach on the other team that she was getting really frustrated with the kids. I mean, you're hurting cats at this age, right? And she kept, scolding them and yelling them. And you could see she started escalating her temper. And then the kids started acting out. And you kind of got to wonder that, maybe if she had just maybe called a timeout, calmed herself down, that would have been a better approach. Who knows? I mean, I can kind of see why she was frustrated, to be honest. Mm-hmm. They were kind of acting a bit silly, but yeah, you know, you want to stay at calm and center is mm-hmm. Is a very important part of coaching. And if you're kind of all over the place and like a ping pong ball, people are going to pick up on that and you're not going to be a very good leader.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Final piece. Is there, and I'm sure that I think everyone's going to be a little bit biased depending on who they work with at the moment, but have you any particular favorites, up-and-coming athletes or coaches that you're really excited to see how they do in the next few years or the next decade or so, that you think that are really, really talented and are people to really look out for in the near future? Any athletes or coaches?
Yeah, I think I'll talk about a coach. Mm-hmm. At Simon Fraser University, we are Canada's only NCAA Division II school. Mm-hmm. And so we compete against American schools. Yeah. And it presents a recruiting challenge for us because we are very academic.
Yeah.
And that's no disrespect to, you know, American kids or mm-hmm. anything like that. But, you know, when they swallow the pill of coming to Simon Fraser, they're going to be challenged academically. Yeah. And that's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. So the two coaches that I work with there are Steve Hansen and Thomas Ford. And Steve Hansen's the men's basketball coach. Mm-hmm. And I've spent the preseason with him this fall and got a chance to listen to him talk to his guys and listen to him run. Every week they did a different team building activity, from scavenger hunts to mm-hmm. different games and whatnot. You know, I just watched him sort of lead his team and develop the character of his players and mm-hmm. how he's recruited not just guys because of their ability to play basketball, because how they fit into that philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited for him this year. They've already won their first three games at home. So I really see big things. And then the second person is Thomas Ford, who was hired at the university to take over our football program that's been struggling for many years with no wins. Mm-hmm. And I really think, you know, he's the guy for the job. You know, nice. I really think that there's going to be, give him 3 years, so including yeah. this year, really turn the program around. But I think that we'll be a GNAC, which is our conference, huge contender in football. You know, he's a great leader and he's got a great staff. So it's not just him when I mention SFU football, it's all of the staff that he works with. And the guys that I talk to, all these coaches are extremely generous with their knowledge and their passion and their energy. Mm. They're tireless.
Nice.
You know, and I like working with people that are like that, that are tireless, that they don't complain about this and that or make excuses. It's like, okay, what are we going to do here? Mm-hmm. So very solution focused. So I'm excited for them. Awesome. I'm excited for Mallory Valte, my American wrestler, because last year when she went to Worlds, she didn't get out of the first round, and this year she won a bronze medal and she won it in an Olympic weight category. So that's extremely awesome. Exciting for her, and she's my youngest.
Nice.
So she's one to watch, you know, she's got a really bright future in the sport.
Mm. Awesome. Well, that's fantastic. Carmen, I have to say I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I think you're more of a legend than I thought you were now, after all.
seriously.
No, it's, but it's yeah, it's yeah. what it's it, you're doing. I think you're doing fantastic work, and it's shown. It's like, it's obviously going to be more and more evident. But I think the fact that you're so well rounded in both coaching and academia, and you just have a very positive approach to both training people and also to your teaching. And even the way you've spoken this evening about it, it's inspiring enough to kind of really make people push on. So I've no doubt people will really, really enjoy the conversation. But thank you so much for joining us.
Let your readers know to reach out, you know, like absolutely. I'm on mm-hmm. social media, like you said, and people can connect and
yeah,
I'll do my best to get back to them in a time. I'm not really that well known, so I do respond to pretty much everyone.
Well, we'll hopefully be fixing that. Yeah, but exactly. Where would people where should people go to catch up with you? And you can kind of
Instagram is probably best. It's just Coach Bot. Mm-hmm. right?
Nice.
So, or if they don't like Instagram, I do have, I did actually start a Facebook page like last week.
Okay.
It's just carmen.msccscs is my
awesome
like work Facebook page or whatever.
Nice,
so
nice, excellent.
Either one. And like cool. I post stuff and people can argue with me. I love it. Go for it.
Nice.
You know, just be prepared for a brawl. That's all.
Sweet. And speaking of brawls, you mentioned that you've just finished, it's another book you've just finished, or another program you finished, The Wrestler's Edge, is it, I think?
Yeah, I have a product I'm putting out in the new year. It's called The Wrestler's Edge 2.0.
Nice.
So it's the second version.
Okay.
And it's insane.
Sweet.
It's insane. I've written so much stuff. So all the stuff on conditioning, it's all going to be there. So
awesome.
Even if like your readership don't train wrestlers, they can still buy it and do the workouts and probably turn themselves into like
legends, beasts,
savages. I'm not sure. But or tell me that it's BS and I'll cry myself to sleep. You know, whatever.
We'll just, either way, we'll just change the plan if we need to. It's all good.
Absolutely.
Super. Well, Carmen, thank you so much for joining me, and have a fantastic day, and we'll chat to you very, very soon.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks a million, Carmen. Cheers.
Okay, folks, so you've just been listening to episode number 41 of the Humble Coach Podcast with Carmen Bott. First of all, a massive thank you to Carmen for joining me on the episode today. I really, really appreciate her taking the time. If you guys would like to check out any of the other episodes on the Humble Coach Podcast, you can find us on Stitcher, on Spotify, on iTunes, and then also on our home base of podbean.com. As always, folks, really, really appreciate all of your support. And until next time, take care.